Welcome to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's only animal rights show, broadcasting from Free FM 89.0 and across New Zealand via the Access Radio Sector. My name's Sandra Kyle, and it's my pleasure to bring you part two of the interview Sarah Oliver and I conducted with Dr. Joe Wills, lecturer in law at the University of Leicester and author of the book Contesting World Order, Socioeconomic Rights and Global Justice Movements. Last week, Dr. Wills, commenting on the Anita Crines case, where she was prosecuted for giving water to overheated pigs in a slaughterhouse truck, explained why the coercive power of the legal system is meant to support those who are harmed. It was not the case during the Crines trial, indeed. It was compassion that was put on trial. We heard how the law reflects the prevailing moral and economic norms in society, and that there will be a time when we look back on what we are now permitted to do to animals as being profoundly unjust, just as, for example, the slave laws were in the 18th and 19th centuries. Dr. Wills spoke about a philosophical system called natural law, which would say that the current status of law concerning animals being transparently unjust in that it sanctions violence against innocents would be no law at all. The current very weak protection for animals the law provides is compounded because of their property status. One way of countering this is to introduce the concept of animal personhood. In part two of the interview, Dr. Wills expands more about recognising animals as persons under the law.
I think the first thing to say probably is what we mean when we talk about person, because too many people, I suspect, the notion of animal personhood might seem like something of a contradiction in terms. And this is because in our everyday conversation, we use person as a synonym for human. So if you say, I just met a really nice person, it will be assumed that you're talking about meeting a human. However, in the law, the concept of a person is used rather differently. A person in the law merely refers to an entity that can possess legal rights and in some cases also possess legal duties. And in various jurisdictions, considering different aspects of the law, the concept of a person has been used to both mean something narrower than the human, but also in other contexts, something broader. So historically, there have actually been some humans that have not been recognized as persons before the law, at least in some contexts. These have included slaves, children, women, serfs, colonial subjects, vagabonds, the cognitively impaired, indentured servants, and others. Today, most legal systems do not recognize zygotes and embryos and fetuses as legal persons, even though we can say that they are within the biological category of Homo sapiens. And in many contexts, certainly in relation to slaves and children and women, it's taken centuries of struggle to achieve equal recognition under the law for these groups who have previously been denied full personhood. But on the other side, not all persons recognized under the law have been persons. So most famously, corporations are recognized as legal persons in various jurisdictions. And the same is true of churches and municipalities and ships. In India, Hindu idols and Sikh holy books have been recognized as persons. In Pakistan, a mosque has been identified as a person, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know. A recent treaty in New Zealand between the Wanui Iwi and the Crown gave a river the status of a legal person. And in fact, very recently, India has followed suit and recognized the rights of two rivers there. And so the question of who is a person before the law is not one of biology, but rather of policy and principle. And I think there are sound principled reasons for recognizing animals as legal persons. So like humans, they are sentient and they have the capacity to feel pleasure and pain. They also have their own desires and preferences. They can also form relationships with others, act in a pro-social manner. They experience a range of emotions, including love and empathy. And some also possess problem-solving abilities and have self-awareness. So they have a range of interests that ought to be protected by the law. Okay, turning to the question of what is the basis for legal personhood. Some have argued that in order to be a legal person, an individual must have quite complex cognitive capacities that allow them to understand morality and moral duties, or have a complex communication system, or the ability to have rationality and so forth. And some people think that animals lack all of these capacities and cannot understand legal duties and therefore should not have any rights or be recognized as persons. A well-known problem in the legal literature and in the bioethics literature, which is known as the problem of marginal cases or the problem of species overlap, that whatever capacity we can identify as humans having that animals don't, we can always find some humans that lack this capacity. So as we've already discussed, the courts in certain jurisdictions have recognized personhood for entities that lack even sentience, such as rivers. And so I think any appeal to cognitive capacity as the basis for excluding animals from personhood is really quite arbitrary.
Ultimately, the law is quite reactive. Laws are passed because of public demand. So the changes we're seeing in law as a result of a changing paradigm, but it's happening pretty slowly. What do you think we can do to bring about real change more quickly in the law?
Yes, I think you're right that the law is principally a reactive institution. It trails behind public opinion and it reflects the prevailing moral norms and economic relations in society. Whilst I think the law is one important site of struggle for animal rights, any progress that is going to be made in that domain, I think you're right, it will be slow and uneven and sporadic given the conservative nature of legal systems. So I think that real change in the way we treat animals will come about through the spread of veganism, which is to say the practice of avoiding engaging in or supporting acts of animal exploitation as far as possible and practicable. So I think the first important thing for animal advocates to do is to go vegan and to encourage and assist others to adopt veganism as well. So I think whilst there is a demand for animal products, there can be little hope that politicians or the courts will do much to rock the boat when it comes to animal rights and the status of animals in society.
It really is up to the average person, isn't it? When there's enough of a groundswell, when enough people call a halt to the obvious injustices, then the law will begin to change.
Yes, I agree. I think largely the change, the shift we want to see has to begin outside of the law, and then the law will play catch-up. In terms of achieving legal personhood for animals, I think that the animal advocacy movement is really in its infancy, that we've seen some glimmers or some beginnings or some opening. So, for example, in 2015, India's Ministry of Environment and Forests outlawed the use of dolphins in aquatic theme parks, and in doing so, they declared that dolphins should be seen as non-human persons and as such have their own specific rights. And in the United States, we have the civil rights organization, the Non-Human Rights Project, who are currently filing lawsuits on behalf of captive chimpanzees, arguing that they are legal persons and ought not to be imprisoned against their will. And this is generating a real debate in the legal academy in the United States at the moment and beyond. And indeed, a group using this same legal strategy in Argentina successfully won a case last December and got a chimpanzee called Celia recognized as a legal person. And the judge ordered that she be released, and she subsequently been released and transferred to a chimpanzee sanctuary in Brazil. And that's a fantastic example of a shift in the law. And of course, it's a movement that's still in its infancy. Mm. It's a strategy that's still in its infancy. At the moment, it's a strategy that's only employed in relation to a very small class of non-human animals that are quite close to humans in their cognitive capacity. So, of course, we can only expect limited progress in the law. And that's why we need a strong movement in civil society challenging the paradigm of animals as property and animals as things for us to use.
Yes. To my way of thinking, what really needs to change is the idea that we can do what the hell we like with sentient beings. And we're creating a demand by continuing to eat meat and dairy products.
Yes, and so we need to challenge that at the root. Promoting veganism is at the root. It's precisely the fact that consumers are creating the demand for these products through their purchasing techniques. Of course, we shouldn't just see it as a demand-side problem. It's also a supply-side problem, and we have issues of governments giving huge subsidies to dairy and meat farmers and, you know, through advertising and so on. So we don't want to just say it's purely a problem at the demand end. It's also a problem at the supply end, but we need to think about political strategies to challenge as well, I think. But on the broader point, I think that, yes, it's the cultural norm that animals are things for us to use, consume, and exploit, when in actual fact, if you live in a developed country, there's no need to consume animal products, and that there are increasingly alternatives and a wide range of vegan options now available in the supermarkets and in the high streets and so on. I think as animal advocates, we really need making people aware of this and their attention to alternatives to animal exploitation.
You're with Safe and Sound. My name's Sandra Kyle, and you're listening to Sarah Oliver's and my discussion with legal academic and author Dr. Jo Wills about the Anita Quines case and animal law in general. Dr. Wills just explained why there's a sound case for adopting legal animal personhood, and promoting veganism goes to the roots of the injustices that we perpetrate on fellow animals. In the next part of the interview, Dr. Wills talks about how animal rights is growing in academia and elsewhere, and how the law is associated with rationality rather than compassion. Publicity around the Quines case has advanced the cause of animal rights, and as Dr. Wills commented, the large animal industries prefer to remain in the shadows. For obvious reasons, the quote by Paul McCartney comes to my mind here, and that is, if slaughterhouses had walls, everyone would be vegetarian. But we can be optimistic, as those of us who speak up against the systematic cruelty to our fellow animals have truth and justice on our side. Let's listen now to the rest of the interview.
Do you notice within academia there's a change in conversation going on at all?
I'm in the United Kingdom, and there's really only a handful of us in the legal academies doing work on animals, unfortunately. But certainly in the United States, there's been a huge boom in study of animal law. In fact, it's the fastest growing area of law in the United States at the moment, I believe, as well.
It's growing here.
Quite strong movement in Australia. Yes. So I think there is a growth in interest in animals and the law in the legal academy, but it's uneven and varies from country to country.
So, I guess in some ways that has to be seen as a hopeful thing. I imagine that perhaps 20 years ago that would have been a very different reaction to anybody exploring this to what there is today, where you're starting to get academics like yourself able to write about it and speak about it and be taken seriously.
Yes, there's certainly an increase in interest.
Is there any place for compassion in the law?
Historically, in the Western context, the law has been very much associated with rationality. Within the Western philosophical tradition, rationality and the emotions have been thought of as opposing. So generally, judges are very concerned to be dispassionate and unswayed by sentiment, feeling, and the like. This style of thinking is quite prevalent in the legal system. That said, of course, judges are human beings too. It's important to remember that. And sometimes you can see their sympathy seep into their judgment. So, and I think this was really true of one of the non-human rights project cases that was heard a couple of years ago in America. Mm-hmm. And this was a case in which the non-human rights project were trying to get two chimpanzees being used in biomedical experiments called Hercules and Leo released from their cages. And they were unsuccessful in their claim, but they got a very sympathetic judgment from Justice Barbara Jaffe. She says in her sort of concluding remark, the similarities between chimpanzees and humans inspire the empathy felt for a beloved pet. Mm. Efforts to extend legal rights to chimpanzees are thus understandable and someday may even succeed. Courts, however, are slow to embrace change and occasionally seem reluctant to engage in broader, more inclusive interpretations of the law. Mm. As Justice Kennedy aptly observed, times can blind us to certain truths and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary, in fact, serve only to oppress. So we see in some instances that compassion at least plays a nominal role in judicial reasoning, but generally it's something that isn't part of legal reasoning as a mode of reasoning, I would say. So that there isn't too much space for compassion in the law, at least not expressly.
I just keep thinking of Jeremy Bentham saying, it is not whether they can think, it is whether they can suffer.
Well, certainly legislators can be motivated to pass new laws by virtue of their sentiment and their empathy. And indeed, in some respect, the Bentham idea of giving animals legal protection by virtue of their sentience has been formally recognised now in many Western legal systems. So under the European Union Treaty of Lisbon, animals are recognised as sentient beings. In New Zealand, animals are recognised as sentient beings. And so in a nominal sense, animal sentience has been recognised by the law as the basis for animal protection. The problem is that animals are still considered less than humans. I think it just boils down to speciesism in the end.
Yes, it boils down to economics, doesn't it? Who's making money? I'm just thinking of my niece who's a lawyer and another friend who's training to be a lawyer. So I guess my question to you, what advice, what thoughts would you give to those entering law who are interested in the field of animal rights? Where would you suggest they start? Because we have lots of young, bright minds coming up.
I think it's useful to be grounded in the ethics around animals. So I think the classic works there are Peter Singer's Animal Liberation and Tom Reagan's The Case for Animal Rights. I think when it comes to studying animals and their relationship to the law, the two classics there would be Gary Francione's Animals, Property and the Law and the work of Stephen Wise, including his 2000 book, Rattling the Cage. So I think those would be good places to start for law students with an interest in animals and animal ethics.
The judge in the Anita Crines case dismissed the charge because the slaughterhouse was aware protesters had given water to pigs before but had never refused to accept a load of pigs for that reason. So it seems that the judgment was straightforward but really didn't advance the animal rights cause. How do you see that our cause has been legally advanced in this case?
I'm not sure whether it's been advanced legally per se, but I do think it's been advanced in a number of other ways. So, firstly, although the judgment theoretically leaves the door open for prosecutions of animal activists engaged in similar activities to Toronto Pig Save in the future, the case was actually terrible publicity for the pork industry. So any future decisions to call for prosecutions for animal rights activists, I think, will be done with great caution. In fact, I'm reminded of a famous English libel lawsuit brought by McDonald's in 1997. Mm. This became known as the McLibel trial. Some of your listeners may have heard of it. Mm-hmm. This was brought against two London Greenpeace activists called Helen Steele and David Morris.
Oh, yes, I remember about this, yes.
Yeah, and they were handing out leaflets that were critical of McDonald's, including on grounds of animal cruelty. Now, although McDonald's were actually partially successful in suing Steele and Morris, the case was an absolute PR disaster for them. It really exposed them as bullies who used their power and wealth to stamp out criticisms of their practices. So sometimes engaging the law can backfire. And in fact, Justice Harris, in the crimes judgment, noted that the decision to prosecute crimes had generated bad publicity for the pork industry. I think this case demonstrates the not insignificant opportunity cost that the prosecution of animal activists might have for the animal agriculture industry, particularly when those animal activists are engaged in non-violent, peaceful demonstrations. So these are industries that want to keep their practices and their operations out of sight. They want to keep these practices invisible. And yet, by pressing for this prosecution, they inadvertently sparked this widespread press and media coverage. And so I think it shows, actually, that we sometimes see the animal agriculture industries as this all-powerful leviathan, but this trial actually exposed them, I think, as paper tigers. But they're hiding in the shadows, and they're really fearful of the truth getting out. This is why they use libel laws and criminal prosecutions and add gag laws and so on to their critics. But I think now the genie is out of the bottle. More and more people are becoming aware of the nature of the injustices of the animal agribusiness industry. And so whilst I think the animal rights movement, we don't have the wealth of the animal agribusinesses, but we do have truth and justice on our side. And
yes,
I think ultimately that will prevail. So I think that the Toronto pig trial really exposes fragility of the animal exploitation industry. But in addition, I also think it opens up a space for a debate about the role that the law plays in maintaining these injustices, and particularly the moral absurdities implicit in the legal classification of animals as property. There was an infamous English case in 1783 called Gregson and Gilbert. And the background to that case was this. There was an Atlantic slave ship called Zong, and it didn't have enough potable water for everybody on the ship. And so the crew actually threw 133 African slaves overboard to their death. And not only that, but the ship's owners then made a claim to their insurance for the loss of the slaves that they'd murdered. And so this insurance claim goes to court. And it loses on technical grounds. But because of this legal dispute, reports of the massacre received publicity, and they actually really helped stimulate the abolitionist movement in the late 18th and early 19th century. And the Zong events were increasingly cited as a symbol of the horrors of the slave trade. Now, I'm not claiming that the Zong case and the Toronto pig slave case are alike. They're obviously different in many respects. And I'm also not claiming that the Toronto pig slave will have the same cultural and political impact for the animal rights movement that the Zong massacre had for the anti-slavery movement. But I do think that what both cases highlight is the horrors that are implicit in the commodification of the bodies of other sentient individuals. And I think that the pig trial does provide a basis for a debate, both amongst lawyers and the general public, about our current classification and treatment of animals as mere chattel property.
Our thanks to Dr. Joe Wills for his very informative discussion with us on animals and the law. As long as there's a demand for animal products, there's little that politicians or the law will do to rock the boat. So it's up to us to go vegan and encourage and assist others to go vegan, to challenge the cultural norm that animals are things for us to use, consume, and do with whatever we like. I was thrilled last week to see on the What Next program the televised real-time poll conducted with New Zealanders about the future we want to see, that veganism had a significant showing and was taken very seriously. Those of us who've campaigned for many years are beginning to see the revolution that we're hoping for take place. In fact, I would even say that it's a sure thing, which just happens to be the name of the track by Saint-Germain that we'll go out on. Thanks, everyone. See you next week. Bye-bye.